I just want to take a second and thank Policy Genius. They're supporting today's episode of Success Story. I know we all have kids, we all have families we want to take care of, and I personally checked something off major on my to-do list, life insurance. It's a tough topic, it's really hard to think about, but it's so important. And the hard part was sorting through all the options. Luckily, I found Policy Genius. Policy Genius is an online insurance marketplace that makes getting life insurance surprisingly easy. With Policy Genius, you can find life insurance policies that start at just $292 per year for $1 million of coverage. Some options offer same-day approval and avoid unnecessary medical exams. Now, knowing my family's protected brings me incredible peace of mind. Don't put off this important decision. Check life insurance off your to-do list in no time with Policy Genius. Head to policygenius.com or click the link in the description to get your free life insurance quotes and see how much you could save. That's policygenius.com. Eufy is sponsoring today's video. They reached out to me. I tested out their video lock. It is a game changer. I'm going to paint a picture for you for why I'm so excited to work with them. So, you're getting home, your arms are loaded with groceries or packages or boxes or everything, and your keys are in your pocket. This drives me nuts. This happens all the time. I upgraded to the Eufy video lock. Fingerprint, tap, I'm inside. And honestly, I also feel way safer. It's got this awesome built-in camera, so whether it's a package delivery or late night Uber order, I see exactly who's there right from my phone. There are no more mystery knocks. And the best part, this thing was such a breeze to set up. There's no wires, there's no drilling. There's also no monthly subscription fees. So if you are done fumbling with your keys, because I definitely am, search for Eufy Video Lock or head over to eufyofficial.com/video lock. Your front door, your sanity. Welcome to the Success Story Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Clary. On this podcast, I have candid interviews with execs, celebrities, politicians, and other notable figures, all who have achieved success through both wins and losses, to learn more about their life, their ideas, and their insights. I sit down with leaders and mentors and unpack their story to help pass those lessons on to others through both experiences and tactical strategy for business professionals, entrepreneurs, and everyone in between. Without further ado, another episode of the Success Story Podcast. All right. Thanks again for joining me. Today, I am very excited to be sitting down with Per Gyllenhammar, former longtime CEO of Volvo, who has a new book coming out in September called Character is Destiny, Reflections on Innovation and Integrity from Volvo's longest serving CEO. Now, a little bit of a background. Per has a 24-year tenure that was historic, groundbreaking in Volvo's history. When he became Volvo's CEO in 1971, he completely redesigned the company's plants, assembly methods, to prioritize the health, well-being of the workers, a man way ahead of his time. He addressed the first global environmental convocation in 1972 UN Environmental Conference and made a public commitment to make Volvo more environmentally friendly and to protest the regime of apartheid. He closed Volvo's Durban plant in South Africa in 1976, one of the first CEOs to divest. In addition to transforming Volvo, Gyllenhammar directly shaped industry in Europe, creating European Roundtable and Industrialists, which conceived of and implemented major infrastructural improvements, such as the France-England Channel Tunnel. He has also worked with or served on the boards of such institutions as Lazard, Reuters, Rothschild, Chase Manhattan Bank, the Aspen Institute, the Rockefeller University, and the London Philharmonic Orchestra. Gyllenhammar's writing has been published on CNN, Business News, Automotive News, and many, many more. Thank you so much for sitting down. Very, very excited to understand how you became the man you are today. So thank you.
Well, you're very welcome. Nice to be with you.
Oh, no, it's my pleasure. It's my pleasure. You, as I read these things off over your career, environmental impact, moving away from countries that don't do business properly like you did in South Africa and whatnot. These all seem to be very commonplace now, and a lot of organizations fall in line with this type of ideology, very forward-thinking. But you have to remember, in 1971, that was not always the case, as you were a leader in many of these. But before that, walk me through how you even became the CEO of Volvo and your career, and then we'll go into what you're doing now.
Well, it was the chairman of Volvo at the time who visited me. I lived in Stockholm at that time. and said, could we have a conversation with you? I said, fine. And then he said, without any ado, he said, we would like you to be the chief executive of Volvo.
And how about did you fall into that role? How did you handle it? What was your, I guess, your preparation for managing such a large company?
Well, I had no preparation, except I was the head of the largest insurance company in the Nordic area for 1 year and 9 months, I think it was, when they came to say that, would you like to join Volvo? And I thought it was so tempting with Volvo as the car and truck manufacturer and aviation and space. So I said yes, without thinking.
Was it difficult to move into a role like that? Did you have struggles, hurdles, or was a lot of it, you were prepared for it?
No, I was not prepared for it at all. It was a great surprise. But I think I said yes within 1 hour while I was still head of Scandia, the insurance company, which was the largest insurance company in the Nordic area. So it was very dramatic in my surroundings. Not least the chairman of Scandia, who thought that I was his golden boy, I think. And he lost me very quickly.
And as you moved into Volvo, you did a lot of things that I think were ahead of their time. How did you come to some of these decisions? As I read off your background, divesting from South Africa, closing the Durban plant, prioritizing, and all these different convocations and other campaigns that you did. Where did that come from? Was that something that you were always championing, or was it just you trying to look ahead of where work and leadership was going at the time?
I was very independent, and I had an examination in law studies. I was a candidate of law, and I don't know why. It was just that it was partly liberal, it was partly historical, it was partly with the time, and I studied both in England and I studied in the United States, and I decided to do the legal studies. And they were terribly boring, and therefore I did it in 3 years instead of the normal 5.5. And after that, I didn't know what to do. I thought earlier that I would like to be an actor, but I discarded that and came to the insurance company and became chief executive, one of the youngest in Europe, really, and then Volvo, where I was also many years the youngest, because many of my colleagues in the automotive industry and in the aviation and space industry, they were about 50 at the time. So I was seen as very young, which probably was true.
And how did you manage that from a leadership perspective, managing all these individuals that were much older than you? Was that difficult?
Well, it was difficult, but I was also, I was vigilant, I was fairly tough. So I wanted to make a totally different organization with a delegation of responsibility. So eventually I had a headquarter of 100 people instead of 2,200 that the company that I took over had. So I slimmed it down. I made every part of the business their own company, subsidiary of a mother company. And that changed also the whole organization, because you had to have a chief executive within the group on every one of these five sections. So it became much more flexible and much more dynamic. And that is what I was looking for. And in 1 year after I exceeded the chief executive. I also called a council of blue collar workers and some white collar workers, because the blue collar workers, when I moved there, I said I will see to it that they are the best and that they have a very good environment, and that is my motto. And we had a council of about 20 people, most of them blue collar workers. So that was how I started.
I want to understand, because I feel, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like a lot of the lessons, so the book is entitled Character is Destiny, which I absolutely love. And it's such a,
yes,
it's such a meaningful title. And I'm sure there's a lot as to why you called it that. But you also, the subtitle is Reflections on Innovation and Integrity from Volvo's Longest Serving CEO. And I think that, you know, I'm realizing this as we speak, like a lot of the lessons that you implemented as CEO of Volvo, I think these are the lessons that are discussed in the book, correct? I want to draw that parallel.
Yes, yeah. Correct.
Good. So as you make these changes to Volvo, as you make it more agile, more lean, you put together a council of blue-collar workers, what are the results that you see? Or rather, you can even speak about it in the reference to your book. Let's speak about how the book is divided and broken down, and maybe that will give a little bit more structure for some of the things that we can chat about too.
Well, you go ahead. You've seen the book.
No, that's fair. So as some of these come out, as you start building out some of these actual processes and programs, what is the result that you see when you put unionized blue-collar workers? Is this something, and I want to put it in perspective for today's listener, for today's reader.
Yeah.
Was this a commonplace in your time, or was this groundbreaking?
It was groundbreaking, because the automotive industry around the world, in the United States, in Europe, and, you know, England and France and Germany, you had the assembly line.
Yeah.
I started a new plant, because we needed more capacity, that had no assembly line. It had assembly, but it didn't have an assembly line, so it was not moving. The blue-collar workers didn't have to move with the assembly line. They could stay, and they could do their mandate, which was at least 20 minutes for a team of 9 to 10. And that made it more interesting for them. It was more demanding. They put together part of a car and the engine and the transmission and the whole system. And there were about three to four teams who could do the whole car. And that was new. And I had interest from people from outside the Sweden at the time. Our biggest market was already in the United States. And when we opened the plant, Henry Ford asked if he could come and visit, and he did. And the head of the Auto Workers Union, he also came and wanted to see it. So I had those two at the same time, and also the Prime Minister of Sweden, who almost came in the shadow behind these rather two giants.
Yeah.
So that was an interesting start. And then we had to close the plant for visitors, because there were too many who wanted to come from different parts of the world. But the plant was successful. It took probably about a year to make it absolutely run in, but then it worked extremely well, and it had platforms that moved through electric engines and just came up to the team that was going to do the work, that, and the shift was about 20 minutes for each team.
It's incredible, because, as you know, you mentioned Henry Ford, who is thought of as almost one of the revolutionaries in the automation process, in the assembly line. And this is taking it to another level. And even just having that kind of observance of what you're doing is, as a younger CEO, that's probably very, very stressful. But I appreciate that a lot. I can only imagine, because these are, you know, when you say a name like that, I think it shows the impact of what you were actually bringing to Volvo. So you're making a ton of changes. You're making socially conscious changes. You're making innovative changes. How can you make these changes without hurting profits, scaring off shareholders or stakeholders? How could you do it then? How can you do it now?
Well, how could I do it then? It takes a bit of imagination. It takes a bit of freedom in thought, and still paying consideration to the people in the company. And I think the blue collar workers were extremely satisfied after a couple of months when they knew the rhythm and how to manage it. And there was so much attention to what we did that became a worldwide story within a couple of months.
And then as that becomes a worldwide story and it starts to work, is that when you gain a little bit more trust in the stakeholders, in the financiers, in whoever, in the customers, you know, everybody who could be a naysayer in innovation? Is that how it unfolded?
I think that that took quite some time, because I think that people, also my countrymen, who is a very small market, the Swedish market or the Nordic market, but they were suspicious. And they thought that it was strange that you could change a mode and the way of building cars the way we did. So there was quite a lot of skepticism.
Do you find that there are lessons that businesses and organizations can learn from to perhaps eliminate some of that skepticism with innovation now? As I go through your book, there's several parts. There's communication, there's innovation, there's all these different things that are very good leadership qualities that I think, without putting words in your mouth, these are things that we should look for in organizations.
Yeah.
And these are things that leaders of organizations should keep top of mind. So were there things that you learned out from being socially conscious and innovative that other people should sort of take heed of?
Well, and they didn't, because in the United States, for example, I think that the automotive industry, for example, is still more or less the same as it was in the 1930s and 1940s, and very little has changed. And it must be very monotonous for the blue collar workers, because they have perhaps 60 seconds or 90 seconds to do one detailed thing, like a bolt or whatever. And it doesn't give them any inspiration. It doesn't give them any knowledge and no know-how on how a car is built. Of course, they know it if they've been there a couple of years. But, you know, also they're physically, it is very difficult, particularly for women, to use men's tools. So I changed all the tools. So there were tools for women and their hands and for the man. And like through a magic, a magic change, all their problems with health disappeared, the women, because they had tools made for women's hands. So that was in itself a revolution. You could have females that didn't have to report themselves suffering. So it all disappeared. So that was one of the good things. And the other thing was that quality improved. because you didn't have to intervene all the time to improve quality. So all the other plants in the system of Volvo, whether it was engine plant, transmission plant, rear axles, front axles, whatever it was, you could benefit from the system that we had at the Kalmar plant. So all the factories were gradually changed to this type of system.
And as you make this change, one point that I saw that I really enjoyed that you made that differentiation to move shareholder capitalism to stakeholder capitalism.
Yes.
What does that mean exactly? And how can we accomplish that?
It means that if you look at some of the systems that are more or less classic now or old fashioned, it was all for the shareholders and fairly good things for the staff. But in my case, I think that shareholders is one thing, and they should understand that there are limits to how much you can distribute. First of all, because you need capital to invest and reinvest. And secondly, because there are other interest groups that are very important. And that's the staff, the labor, it's the society where you're working, it's taxpayers' money, part of it, that your profit goes to. So you have to be much more diverse than just think of the shareholders and the chief executives. And I must say, within brackets there, that I am shocked by the salaries that chief executives get in the United States. I think it's grotesque. And if they leave after 5 years, they get a bonus, even if they're bad or if they're good, they get a bonus. And the bonus is a few times more than their annual salary. So I find that, not acceptable, because I think that there are more things to do if you have a well-functioning or even badly functioning organization, that you have to distribute the profits.
And that the sky-high CEO pay, golden parachutes when they leave an organization, that extra bonus, is that not something, and excuse my naivety, I'm looking at it from a lens of North America.
So yeah.
That's not something that you see as much in Europe, or is it still prevalent?
Well, it is prevalent in the United States. So if you compare to salaries, for example, in Europe, or perhaps in Japan, I don't know Japan that well. I've been there many times, but I don't know exactly what they say and what they mean. But in most of Europe, the salaries and remuneration for chief executives are more modest, quite different from in the United States. Mm-hmm. But in Europe, they've also increased a lot, a bit inspired by the United States. And I think, when you've been 5 years in a company, you have not learned very much about that company. You haven't contributed very much. And when you are 5+, you get a very high salary, even if you've failed completely.
Mm-hmm. Now, these are all things I love. I love the direction this is going. So socially conscious companies, moving shareholder capitalism to stakeholder capitalism.
Yeah.
Even, making sure that CEO pay, that executive pay. These are all great leadership lessons, but it's hard to implement them.
Yes, it is.
Outside of a complete cultural change, how do you do? And I don't even know if there is a correct answer. I think somebody would have thought through it. But what's your opinion on how you actually revolutionize the workforce in a positive way?
Well, I had people around me were very very surprised that I devoted so much time to the blue-collar workers. But I thought from the first hour that I came to Volvo that they are the core of the company. If we can't have a blue-collar force that is both women and men and adapted tools adapted to how they could work better, more smoothly, less damage and less injuries, that would be great. So I got a very close relationship with them. And I remember when I first visited the biggest plant in where we were based, and I came down in a suit and a tie, and the head of the plant said to me, "Could you take off the tie, sir?" I said, "Why would I take off the tie?" Oh, he said, "You know, the workers here, they don't like people with tie." I said, "I don't care. I don't care, and they will not care about me when they see me." So I went in, and there was a lot of, you know, curiosity when they had the new, very young head of the company. Mm-hmm. And after a year or so, and I visited all our plants as I went around the world, and always had the suit that I usually had and tie. And I didn't have to take my tie off just to go for 45 minutes in per plant. So they accepted that. And they, after a couple of years, I had approval ratings, because we also measured approval ratings from different parts of the world and different parts of the company. And I got a sky high, after a couple of years, approval rating from the blue collar workers.
Mm-hmm. I think it goes without saying it's because you focus on building that relationship with them, which you know, it's something you were doing in the 70s, and it's something that companies still miss the mark on today. Probably less.
Yeah, they
probably
do. Less. They do. But
they definitely do. Now, another model you speak about is the ESG, environmental, social, and governance investing model. Is that a way to make companies more in line with these values that you brought into Volvo in the 70s?
I didn't quite understand the term there.
So the ESG model, environmental, social, and governance investing model.
I've seen that, but I've seen it later than I started it, because I think that has been developed, and yes, there's so many vocabularies around industries. I excuse myself when I say that to you, but I don't quite get some of these terms, and I was extremely interested in the environment, and I can tell you one little anecdote that when we came with my first new model, which was looked like the previous one but was totally different inside, and the whole driveline was different, and there was a new authority in the United States, 1974, about the way that you marketed your cars, and they sent a demand to the company and said,
"I know a lot of entrepreneurs listen to this show, and NetSuite has been a huge supporter for entrepreneurs, for business owners, because there's one thing that we all know. Business is about making money, and it's about your bottom line. And the less you spend on the nuts and bolts of running your business, the more profits you keep. But these days, everything is costing more. Supplies, people, shipping. It squeezes your margins. And I've been there, juggling multiple systems for finance, inventory, you name it. Each with its own costs and its own set of headaches. That's why I made the switch to NetSuite by Oracle. It's changed our company. Think about it. NetSuite is one of the top financial systems out there. It puts your whole business on one platform: accounting, finance, the works. One data source for everyone. There's no more mismatched info. And because it's in the cloud, it slashes your IT costs. No more servers, no more updates. Just access NetSuite from anywhere. With one integrated suite, your overhead drops big time. And here's the real win. Efficiency. Everything's connected in NetSuite. Costs are ridiculous lately. Find a proven way to reduce your expenses and get better performance out of your team. It's a no-brainer, and that's what NetSuite offers. Over 37,000 companies have figured this out already. You have to join them. Right now, through to April 15th, NetSuite's got an incredible, flexible financing plan. Check it out and see the savings yourself at netsuite.com/ScottClary. That's netsuite.com/ScottClary. Hiring as a small business owner is a major pain. That's why LinkedIn is supporting today's episode. You need people with the right skills and experience, but finding them can take forever. It is incredibly frustrating to keep seeing candidates who just aren't a good fit, and that's why LinkedIn Jobs has been a game changer. Let me tell you a little story. We needed to hire a graphic designer, somebody with specific tech and software knowledge and the ability to truly understand our brand. And I started with all the usual job boards, and it's the same old story. Tons of irrelevant applications. No one's really matching my needs. I tried LinkedIn Jobs, and the quality of candidates was just on another level. People with impressive portfolios, relevant expertise. I finally felt like I was interviewing the right people. That's truly the power of LinkedIn's massive professional network. You're tapping into this huge pool of talent you simply wouldn't find on other sites. It's about finding those niche candidates you actually need. And with the right people in front of you, hiring becomes a breeze. Did you know that 86% of small businesses find a qualified candidate on LinkedIn Jobs within 24 hours? That is how well their system works. Honestly, do yourself a favor and try LinkedIn Jobs next time you're hiring. You can post your job for free at linkedin.com/excellence. That's linkedin.com/excellence. Terms and conditions apply, but it's definitely worth trying out. I don't know about you, but the idea of being harassed, scammed, or even worse, all because somebody found my personal information online, that's terrifying. Our political opinions, our addresses, even stuff about our families, it's out there for anyone to grab. And did you know that data brokers are allowed to sell information on over 98% of Americans? It's scary stuff. That's why I've partnered with Delete Me. I personally use Delete Me. They're a big friend of the podcast because I put myself out there online. So safety is a huge concern. It's really scary how easy it is to find someone's details and information, but Delete Me creates a layer of protection that we all need. You tell Delete Me what you want gone, and they make it disappear from those sketchy data broker sites. And Delete Me doesn't stop. They constantly monitor the web to keep your information off those lists. It's like having a privacy watchdog that never sleeps. You need to take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me. They're giving a special discount for all Success Story podcast listeners. Get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/success and use promo code success at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/success and enter code success at checkout. joindeleteme.com/success. Hey everyone, I just want to take a second and thank the sponsor of today's episode, Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond Bourbon. Now, I don't have a lot of liquor sponsors on this show. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond is actually one of my favorites. I've drank it for a few years now, and this is why we actually decided to work together. Heaven Hill Distillery, family-owned since 1935, is a great entrepreneur story too. So there's five brothers. They filled their first whiskey barrels back in 1935, and their legacy still lives on today. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond is aged over 7 years. That's three more than required by the Bottled and Bond Act of 1897. This means the best quality, the best purity, and the best consistency. This is not just average bourbon. It's the winner of the double gold medals at multiple 2023 World Spirits competitions, and they've won the very prestigious Triple Still Award. It's a very big deal in the liquor and bourbon world. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond boasts an exceptionally smooth oak flavor, while its aroma offers a sweet blend of caramel and smooth vanilla. If you love bourbon, you need to try Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond. Available nationally, look for a bottle at your local store. Heaven Hill reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely. Think back to your last few days in the office. Did any of them leave you feeling really accomplished? Not the kind of day where you're running around like crazy, but where you've made real progress on something that matters. Because being busy doesn't always mean being productive, and I bet you we've all been there, and maybe it's time to rethink what it means to get things done. Today's episode is sponsored by Belay. And what they help you do is, instead of getting sucked into emails and to-do lists, they help you delegate tasks and focus on big goals. They can connect you with top-notch US-based talent who are ready to take on those time-consuming tasks that bog you down. Let's be real. There are way more important things you could be doing than bookkeeping or wrangling a packed inbox. They have virtual assistants to handle all of those pesky administrative tasks, or accounting professional to take care of all your financials. But here's the best part. You don't have to waste weeks searching for the right person. Belay's personalized matching service works quickly, sometimes matching you with the right talent to take stuff off your plate in under a week. Are you ready to try a different way of working? Check out Belay's list of the top 25 things you can delegate to a virtual assistant. It might just change your business and your life. Text SUCCESS, that's SUCCESS, to 55123 to get the list and to start transforming your to-do list with Belay.
That we would like you to come over and explain how you can have a language where you say that in Sweden cars are so and so. So normally a company of any size says, we'll send someone over, a lawyer or someone in the country itself. And I got so upset over this reproach from a new authority. So I took a plane the next day to Washington. And before I did, I asked the chief executive of that agency that was new and just created. I said, I'm coming myself. Am I welcome? And he was so surprised. He said, oh, you are the chief executive. I said, yes, that's why I'm coming. So I met him in his office, which was, an office in Washington that was fairly spacious. And I was so upset when I came in. So I was polite when I said hello, but then I also, threw myself at him. I said, I don't understand what this is. And I said, I think that it's so important for me and for all my employees to understand what you are after here. And he said, Mr. Gyllenhammar, come to the window here. So I came to the window and he said, this is a big parking space. Can you see that row? I said, yes. And he said, can you see my car? And he illustrated the color. And then I said, that's my Volvo. Isn't that quite something?
That is. I like that a lot.
And then he shook hands and he said, lovely to see you. You are one of the first visitors, but you are definitely the first important visitor that I've had. Otherwise, they come, with from their legal department.
I like that. And that was all just highlighting the importance of the environmental focus on how you marketed, how you built out the brand.
Yeah. Yeah.
The other thing that I really wanted to understand, and then I'm going to give you some, if there's anything else that I missed, what is one point that you've made is short-termism. So short-sightedness in corporate governance, and then its impact on income inequality.
Yeah.
How do you see us fixing that piece? And what is that piece about?
I think it is really more than just rules and regulations and paragraphs. It is your view of the whole corporation, the entire corporation. Who is interested to work there? Who is interested to improve? Who is interested to be a very good person with customers and understand the role of customers? Not only that you have to sell it, but that you have to maintain it, that the quality the environmental care, all those things are one whole thing and one whole system. And it that was also the part of when we came into the we made the engines for the aircraft, fighter aircraft and attack aircraft, and that was partly exported. And then we came to be a partner in the European Space Agency, and our spacecraft, we lifted off the ramp, we lifted with our base the whole skyrocket.
Very impressive.
So we had so many interests, and then we had marine engines as well. But my whole world, what I tried to inspire to my blue collar workers, the white collar workers, and the management, is how we should think. And if they couldn't accept it, fine. That then I would say goodbye to them. But most of them would accept it, and they were proud of it. So that was one piece of the business.
The one driving point that really is hitting me as I go through this is these things all make so much sense. It's common sense to focus on long term. It's common sense to focus and be socially conscious. A few other things, but it's about doing, right? It's about actually acting on this stuff. Now I have a couple more questions that I like to ask that are sort of rapid fire about your career. But before I get into that, is there anything that I didn't ask about the book or about the reflections that you spoke on in the book that you wanted to touch on?
No, I can just perhaps mention a few of the periods in my life where I did different things. So after 23, 24 years at Volvo, as head of Volvo all the time, I left because, first of all, I thought it was time. And secondly, I had other potential successors that I would let come through. So I moved, and I had, first of all, a period where when I thought that we should have better environmentally friendly vehicles, I organized a club that was called the Club of the 17s, of the 17. So it's like the council around Prince King Arthur's court from the middle from the 14th or 15th century. But so we were 17, and we were only industrialists, and we were not anything else. And the 17 we started, and my proposal was that we should make an environmentally friendly place of Europe. So I met with leaders of governments. I was the chairman of the club. I met with President Mitterrand, who was the president of France for two periods, and with his finance minister, who became the head of the European Union, the chief executive of the European Union. And I had to talk to these people, and also the German chancellor and others, to get their attention to what we would like to do, because otherwise it would be a total bureaucracy. And one thing that was quite amazing is that I met President Mitterrand, and I met him at a little private dinner with one of his associates, and he was eating his oysters, and I was telling him what I wanted him to know. And I said, "Monsieur le Président," I said, "you are going to miss Mrs. Thatcher within 3 days or 2 days. And I have a message for you to give her, namely, propose to her a tunnel under the English Channel. Not a bridge, but a tunnel. He came back, and I got a telephone call 4 days later. It'd been only 2 days with her. And he said, it's done. We have agreed to have that channel tunnel made. And I think that was quite sensational.
I think that, well, that's a huge, that's a huge point in your life.
We organized for a second tunnel under the Alps. They had one. A first tunnel under the Pyrenees between France and Spain. And partly new motorways around Europe. And the high-speed trains, the French were the best. And they had a network over most of Europe when I left the Round Table of European Industrialists.
Very impressive. And what do you work on now? What's your current focus?
Well, my current focus is, first of all, I am an advisor to the chairman of Thomson Reuters. You know, Reuters was bought by Thomson's in Canada, and Thomson Reuters is the name. And I was the chairman of the founder share company of Reuters for 15 years, which is the longest that anyone has served, because I was asked to come to Reuters when they listed their shares. So they said, we need 3 new independent directors, one American, one English, and one European. I was a European. And the American was the head of Citicorp.
Now, as you know, as this book comes out, is there anything else that you've had, like, such an impressive life and a very impressive resume? What else do you want to do? Or is this?
Well, I will die fairly soon, I suppose. But what I did after Volvo and the other things I've done is I was asked by the chairman of a British insurance company called Commercial Union if I wanted to be the chairman. And then I had moved, moved away from Volvo. Mm-hmm. And I said yes. And then when I looked at it, I said, it's a fairly small company. Will it be possible to compete in the international world? And he smiled a little bit. He said, it's gone fairly well. But I merged that company, Commercial Union, within 6 months with a bigger company called General Accident, which was Scottish. And that merger came to fruition without any premium. Mm-hmm. No, just the value they had on the stock exchange. And then the third one I acquired within two years later. And that became the biggest insurance company in the United Kingdom. And that was created in 3 years.
Very impressive. Very impressive. You don't stop. You never retire. You just keep going. Very good. All right. So let me ask a couple insights from your life. And they don't have to, whatever you feel comfortable with. What advice would you give somebody who's younger in their career trying to pursue something similar to yours?
I would say that if they are fairly fresh in mind, they should be without partisan weaknesses, They should have integrity, independence, and freedom from bias. They should be, you know, rid of a lot of sanctions that they may have had from other parties in their education, and that to be neutral and unbiased is a very good thing.
Very good.
And it makes you much more open-minded.
Agreed. Very, very much agreed. I think that's one of the issues that we're seeing with a lot of individuals right now. It's so polarized. Where do you go to learn and stay on top of what's relevant? Is there a resource, a person?
No, it's not a resource or person, but I have a couple of long-term friends. For example, David Rockefeller. He came the year that I became head of Volvo. He asked if he could see me, and he came literally 4 weeks after I had started as my career as chief executive. And then he remained a friend until he passed away when 101 years old, a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And then I met Henry Kissinger when I was at Aspen Institute, where I tried to make peace between the Middle Eastern states, which was quite an interesting travel.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know what Aspen Institute is?
When the Aspen Institute? No, I do know Mr. Kissinger though, but I don't know the Aspen Institute. What is that?
Now, the Aspen Institute was an institute that was founded, I think, in the 60s and was very much based in California and San Francisco. And then a leadership appeared that made it a more or less global force. First global in the United States, and then almost global around the world. And I was invited once to that. There I met Henry Kissinger the first time.
Oh, I understand. Okay, that makes sense then. So that's, okay, gotcha.
And then they said, because there were top people that came to the Aspen Institute, which was in Colorado at the time. Aspen, Colorado. That's why it's called Aspen Institute. And they said, well, Perry Ulama, we would like you to chair this group. How many people would you like to have? I said, no one. They said, no one. I said, I think it's better alone and with one deputy, because coming a group, it's like an adventure. Or it's like diplomats, and I don't like it. I like to talk to the leaders directly. So I met with Anwar Sadat, the head of Egypt at the time, and who was killed. And I visited Israel, I visited Jordan, and I flew with a private plane from Jerusalem to Amman, which was forbidden, and I had to have permit from the ambassador or the consul in Jerusalem and the king of Jordan.
It took
10 minutes and to fly. I mean, it's just next door to Jerusalem. But anyway, and then I met with Arafat, and then I met with the prime minister in Israel, and we had a very good package when I came back from the Middle East to New York and to Aspen Institute. Because they thought it was quite remarkable. And the problem was that Carter was the president, and he had only one term. And in December, it was clear that he was going to be succeeded by Ronald Reagan, who knew nothing about politics. And when this was presented to him, and his deputy, not deputy, but foreign secretary, Alexander Haig, who was like a tin soldier, a puppet, and very, very difficult to talk to. And he was just engaged with Reagan. And he was the infamous person who, when Reagan was shot, he said, "I'm now in charge," and moved into the White House. And that was a serious mistake, because it was the vice president who should have done it. Mm-hmm. And that was partly the end of him. But also Reagan, who had no experience of foreign office and foreign services and international diplomacy, he wouldn't even listen to this. He thought it was something so strange to him that he wouldn't deal with it.
That's a very interesting story. Very, very interesting story.
Yeah.
Very good. What was I going to say? What would be a lesson that you would tell your younger self?
Well, a lesson I would tell my younger self is not to give a specific advice on anything, but be open-minded, have integrity, has freedom from bias, and try to be a very decent person. Mm-hmm. And take real care about the people you have in your employ, if you have anyone in your employ. Be open-minded, you can be sharp, you can be tough, but you have to be absolutely honest, fair, and generous.
Very good. And what's one way that you think that we can all make the world a slightly better place?
Well, I think it's late now to make it a better place. because the environment is such a disaster. And you have disasters everywhere. I mean, the oceans are dirty, and the species in the world for growth, 70% have already gone, destroyed completely. So there's 30% left. And it's really a world that we have destroyed gradually and violently when modern technology has come. And it's very late. So that is one thing to watch. The other thing to watch is, of course, this new virus, mm-hmm. the coronavirus, because this is a plague of some sort. And if you look at how the United States has behaved under Trump, I mean, it's a total scandal. Mm-hmm. And he says, we have had made more testing of patients than anyone else in the world, which is total nonsense. I mean, he lies about everything. But so how he does with the United States and really the Western world is a disaster. So I think that, first of all, one has to understand where these plagues come from and how you deal with it. And that will take a bit of time. And then learn from it, and then also understand how fragile the world is, because the North Pole now, the ice is melting very briskly now. It hasn't come to Antarctica yet, but it will come. So if I would be born again now, I would really devote quite a lot of energy to those things.
That's wise words, and you know, you've done so much with your life. It's something that behooves us all to sort of take a second look at, who are younger in our careers,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Before it's too late. And the last question before I get some places to go and get the book and find out more about what you're working on now. What does success mean for you?
Success means many different things, but the most important thing is that the people I serve and the people I work with feel that they get something, even if it is against them. The wind blows the other direction, that they have the faith to believe and to stand by and to work and do good things, irrespective of how it fares, and that there is a good intention behind everything they are asked to do or hoping to do. So I think that's the most important, and integrity and independence, I think, are very valuable, and freedom from bias. Because if you have those three, you will do well.
And lastly, most important, where do people connect with you? Website? Is there Amazon for the book, of course? And when does that release?
I think it's about to be released.
Let me just take a look here. For the website, you can go to PerYillenhammer.com. So that's an easy one.
Yes.
And everything is there. And then LinkedIn as well. LinkedIn.com for PerYillenhammer. And then I think that the book will obviously be on the website, but it will also be on Amazon. So it's coming out September, so soon. You're about a month away. But Character is Destiny, Reflections on Innovation and Integrity from Volvo's Longest Serving CEO. So I'll link that in the comments so people can go find all the links. But that's all I have.
Okay. Is that enough for you? Yes.
It's perfect. It was incredible. Yes. Thank you so much, sir. I appreciate your time.
Well, you're very welcome. And it was good to talk to you.
That's all for today. Thanks again for joining me on another episode of the Success Story Podcast. You can download or stream this podcast wherever podcasts are available, including iTunes, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and many others. You can also watch this podcast on YouTube. If you haven't already, please subscribe and share this podcast with your friends, family, coworkers, and peers. Please leave us a rating on iTunes. It takes about 30 seconds as it allows other people to find our podcast and lets our amazing guests reach even more people with their message. And remember, any rating is fine as long as it contains 5 stars. I'm Scott Clary from the Success Story Podcast, signing off.
I know a lot of entrepreneurs listen to this show, and NetSuite has been a huge supporter for entrepreneurs, for business owners, because there's one thing that we all know. Business is about making money, and it's about your bottom line. And the less you spend on the nuts and bolts of running your business, the more profits you keep. But these days, everything is costing more. Supplies, people, shipping. It squeezes your margins, and I've been there, juggling multiple systems for finance, inventory, you name it. Each with its own costs and its own set of headaches. That's why I made the switch to NetSuite by Oracle. It's changed our company. Think about it. NetSuite is one of the top financial systems out there. It puts your whole business on one platform, accounting, finance, the works. One data source for everyone. There's no more mismatched info. And because it's in the cloud, it slashes your IT costs. No more servers, no more updates. Just access NetSuite from anywhere. With one integrated suite, your overhead drops big time. And here's the real win. Efficiency. Everything's connected in NetSuite. Costs are ridiculous lately. Find a proven way to reduce your expenses and get better performance out of your team. It's a no-brainer, and that's what NetSuite offers. Over 37,000 companies have figured this out already. You have to join them. Right now, through to April 15th, NetSuite's got an incredible, flexible financing plan. Check it out and see the savings yourself at netsuite.com/Scott Clary. That's netsuite.com/Scott Clary. Hiring as a small business owner is a major pain. That's why LinkedIn is supporting today's episode. You need people with the right skills and experience, but finding them can take forever. It is incredibly frustrating to keep seeing candidates who just aren't a good fit, and that's why LinkedIn Jobs has been a game changer. Let me tell you a little story. We needed to hire a graphic designer, somebody with specific tech and software knowledge and the ability to truly understand our brand. And I started with all the usual job boards, and it's the same old story. Tons of irrelevant applications. No one's really matching my needs. I tried LinkedIn Jobs, and the quality of candidates was just on another level. People with impressive portfolios, relevant expertise. I finally felt like I was interviewing the right people. That's truly the power of LinkedIn's massive professional network. You're tapping into this huge pool of talent you simply wouldn't find on other sites. It's about finding those niche candidates you actually need. And with the right people in front of you, hiring becomes a breeze. Did you know that 86% of small businesses find a qualified candidate on LinkedIn Jobs within 24 hours? That is how well their system works. Honestly, do yourself a favor and try LinkedIn Jobs next time you're hiring. You can post your job for free at linkedin.com/excellence. That's linkedin.com/excellence. Terms and conditions apply, but it's definitely worth trying out. I don't know about you, but the idea of being harassed, scammed, or even worse, all because somebody found my personal information online, that's terrifying. Our political opinions, our addresses, even stuff about our families, it's out there for anyone to grab. And did you know that data brokers are allowed to sell information on over 98% of Americans? It's scary stuff. That's why I've partnered with Delete Me. I personally use Delete Me. They're a big friend of the podcast because I put myself out there online. So safety is a huge concern. It's really scary how easy it is to find someone's details and information, but Delete Me creates a layer of protection that we all need. You tell Delete Me what you want gone, and they make it disappear from those sketchy data broker sites. And Delete Me doesn't stop. They constantly monitor the web to keep your information off those lists. It's like having a privacy watchdog that never sleeps. You need to take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me. They're giving a special discount for all Success Story podcast listeners. Get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/success and use promo code success at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/success and enter code success at checkout. joindeleteme.com/success. Hey everyone, I just want to take a second and thank the sponsor of today's episode, Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond Bourbon. Now, I don't have a lot of liquor sponsors on this show. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond is actually one of my favorites. I've drank it for a few years now, and this is why we actually decided to work together. Heaven Hill Distillery, family owned since 1935, is a great entrepreneur story too. So there's five brothers. They filled their first whiskey barrels back in 1935, and their legacy still lives on today. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond is aged over 7 years. That's three more than required by the Bottled and Bond Act of 1897. This means the best quality, the best purity, and the best consistency. This is not just average bourbon. It's the winner of the double gold medals at multiple 2023 World Spirits competitions, and they've won the very prestigious Triple Still Award. It's a very big deal in the liquor and bourbon world. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond boasts an exceptionally smooth oak flavor, while its aroma offers a sweet blend of caramel and smooth vanilla. If you love bourbon, you need to try Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond. Available nationally, look for a bottle at your local store. Heaven Hill reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely. Think back to your last few days in the office. Did any of them leave you feeling really accomplished? Not the kind of day where you're running around like crazy, but where you've made real progress on something that matters. Because being busy doesn't always mean being productive, and I bet you we've all been there, and maybe it's time to rethink what it means to get things done. Today's episode is sponsored by Belay, and what they help you do is, instead of getting sucked into emails and to-do lists, they help you delegate tasks and focus on big goals. They can connect you with top-notch US-based talent who are ready to take on those time-consuming tasks that bog you down. Let's be real. There are way more important things you could be doing than bookkeeping or wrangling a packed inbox. They have virtual assistants to handle all of those pesky administrative tasks or accounting professional to take care of all your financials. But here's the best part. You don't have to waste weeks searching for the right person. Belay's personalized matching service works quickly, sometimes matching you with the right talent to take stuff off your plate in under a week. Are you ready to try a different way of working? Check out Belay's list of the top 25 things you can delegate to a virtual assistant. It might just change your business and your life. Text SUCCESS, that's SUCCESS, to 55123 to get the list and to start transforming your to-do list with Belay.